Good afternoon. I call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, again, still, May 3rd, 2022. The time is 1:17 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilson will be along shortly. He is here. Come on in, Senator. And you're welcome. Brief at ease. Okay, thank you. We're back on the records. So I was at Senator Wilikowski, Senator Olson, Senator Von Imhoff is excused, my Senator Stedman, and Senator Wilson are both here, myself, Chair Bishop. First action item this afternoon is SB 39, ballot custody tampering, voter registration by mail. Then we'll take an at ease and switch out chairs, and we'll have a conversation on SB 164, appropriations, capital, reapproves, HB 281, appropriations, operating budget and loans, HB 282, appropriations, mental health budget. Senator Schauer, I believe you had some brief introductions you wanted to make before we get into the invited testimony and public testimony.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for putting this in the docket. I know time is short, so for the record, Senator Schauer, District E. I just wanted the committee to know, Mr. Chairman, that we have two experts from various topic level, one at the national level that has a lot of data on national best practices and information that I think might be useful to the committee. Second one, specifically, we'll talk to open source because there were a lot of questions about that, how and the why. So I'll keep it to that level. There have been brief, 60,000 foot view, 5 minutes or less, and then open for questions. I just wanted to let everybody know that we have used them before, and I think you'll find it valuable. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Okay. Public testimony is now, invited testimony is now open. So our first testifier is Mr. Matt Rowe, open source voting expert. Mr. Rowe, are you with us? Can you hear us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, just a minute. We're going to please put yourself on the record in 5 minutes, please, and I'd ask you to stay to the hard limit of 5 minutes. I apologize, but we're at that point in the year where we're crunched for time.
Understood. I will just get started then. First off, my name is Matt Rowe, and I'm located in Oakland, California. I currently work at Voting Works, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that builds open source election technology. First off, thank you, Chair Bishop and members of the committee, for the invitation to speak on the topic of open source voting technology this afternoon. The goal of my testimony today is to very briefly describe what open source software is and how open source software applies to election administration, as well as answer any questions on this topic from members of the committee. My testimony reflects my experience from implementing open source election technology at Voting Works, but I will not be speaking to the specifics of Voting Works products. I'd like to first explain what it means for software to be open source. The source in open source refers to source code. The source code for a piece of software is the set of instructions written by programmers that a computer follows to achieve the desired software's behavior. For example, source code may instruct the computer to display a button on screen and then take a particular action upon the user tapping that button. Source code is like a complicated recipe for baking an intricate cake. And much like tasting a cake doesn't involve looking at the recipe, using software does not involve looking at the source code. In fact, for most software, the source code is kept secret, available only to the original programmers. By contrast, open source software is software where the source code is always available to anyone who wishes to see it, much like a cake sold with its recipe attached or published on a website. Much of the software we use today is open source, including all major web browsers and most of the software that powers the internet. Whenever you visit a website, you are using open source software. Open source software is utilized in nearly every industry, including scientific research, financial services, and cybersecurity. The key benefit of open source technology is transparency. Anyone is free to review the source code to understand in detail how the system behaves. In our baking analogy, this means everyone can see every ingredient, its amount, and how the various ingredients are combined. In the world of election administration, especially at a time where our country is particularly polarized, open source transparency provides a common ground of facts that we can all trust because everyone can perform their own verification. Allegations of internet-connected voting systems or malicious code that changes votes can be dispelled by an analysis of the publicly available source code. Given that all open source software is out in the open, a technical review of the source code can be conducted by any independent computer security expert that you choose and you trust. Election officials know that securing elections requires facts and transparency. Proper security procedures must be followed, and those procedures should be transparent for the world to see and evaluate for themselves. Election officials are publicly accountable for the work they do, more so than almost any profession. The transparency of open source software mirrors this public accountability. Now that I've defined what open source software is and why it's important for election technology, I'd like to briefly discuss how open source voting systems are used in practice. The important point to remember is that an open source voting system is used just like any other voting system. The well-established practices for certifying, testing, and operating voting equipment do not change when using open source voting systems. If an existing closed source voting system vendor decided to open source their software tomorrow, the equipment and user experience would not change at all. The only difference would be that the source code is open for everyone to inspect and understand. The only change that open source software introduces into the election process is increased transparency and increased public confidence in the election outcome. Overall, Senate Bill 39 represents a nonpartisan commitment to increasing the transparency and security of Alaskan elections throughout the entire life cycle of the election. Voter registration and signature verification improvements ensure only legitimate ballots are cast. Open source software provides transparency as to how the ballots are counted, and post-election audits confirm the election outcome. Thank you for your time, and I welcome any questions from the committee.
Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess you could, if there were open source election computer software right now, my guess is probably 95 plus percent, if not more, of the people, it would be meaningless. They would not understand what it means. It would mean something for the computer programmers. And I'm just wondering if by having open source election software, does that make it easier for hackers to go in and exploit problems, security flaws with it?
So with respect to the security question, after decades of using open source software in industries outside of elections, it's well understood that open source software actually increases security as transparency encourages secure software development. I like to use the example that everyone always drives the speed limit next to state troopers, and many drivers speed up once the state trooper exits the highway. Similarly, when software is designed and built in secret, that lack of transparency often leads to sloppy shortcuts and insecure coding practices simply because no one is watching. And as I described in my opening remarks, open source software is designed in the open with everyone watching. This creates a very strong incentive to properly design the software. And in particular, designing in view of the public strongly encourages separation between the public source code and the secret bits used to operate the software. For example, the secret keys used to digitally sign cast vote record files. I use this example because historically a number of voting system flaws have emerged from an improper separation of software code and operational secrets. This is a mistake that open source practices regularly prevent. Most importantly, recent Department of Defense memos on open source software support this perspective. According to the Department of Defense, releasing source code does not give attackers an edge, because attackers have many powerful ways to find attack paths into the software that don't require looking at the source code. In the case of elections, we can even make a stronger statement. It would be very foolish to think that our enemies, many of which are capable state actors, don't already have the source code to our voting systems. However, to quote the Department of Defense's FAQ on open source, quote, making source code available to the public significantly aids defenders. Continuous and broad peer review enabled by publicly available source code improves software reliability and security, end quote. So, in short, in my opinion, there's no downside to releasing source code to the public, while there's plenty of upside. Now all the good guys have access to the source code, too.
Further questions from committee members? Seeing none, Mr. Rowe, thank you for calling in today from California, and we appreciate your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Logan Churchwell from the Public Interest Legal Foundation. And Mr. Churchwell, can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me all right?
Very good. And if you could put yourself on the record and keep it at 5 minutes, we would greatly appreciate it.
All right. My name is Logan Churchwell. I am the research director for the Public Interest Legal Foundation. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit law firm dedicated to election integrity based in Indianapolis. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for the invitation to participate in today's hearing. Let me start you off with a quick story. In 2011, a man I'll call John registered to vote despite being a foreign national in the state of Alaska. He did so using a standard paper application and checked the box for, yes, I am a citizen of the United States. And I have this paper application digitized in front of me, and if you look at it, I'm sure it looked like many other dozens that probably went through the elections office at that time. It has his full name. It has an address that is in Alaska. The mailing address also points to a place in Alaska. He gave information showing last four digits of Social Security number, enough that when the document was provided to me, it had to be redacted. He provided his date of birth. He checked all the boxes that were necessary. He said that he is a man. He did not declare a specific political party. And his application was approved, nothing out of the ordinary. But later, in 2014, a comparison was performed between Alaska's voter roll against the Permanent Fund Dividend database of recipients. And it actually turned out that our friend John, when he was applying for the PFD benefit, actually said that, no, he's actually not a U.S. citizen. This discrepancy was caught, and the Alaska Division of Elections sent John a letter saying that if you are indeed a foreign national, as you've told this other office, you're in violation of the law. It is illegal to be registered to vote and not be a U.S. citizen. If this is indeed true, then you need to sign this form that we're attaching for you, admitting that you are not a U.S. citizen. And 10 days later, John responded. He sent the letter back and checked the box saying, you're right, I am not a U.S. citizen. And he was removed from the voter roll. John's case serves as proof of concept that when Alaska engages in best practices in maintaining its voter roll on a permanent and comprehensive basis, the roll can become more accurate. It is for this reason that PILF rises in support of SB 39. The heart of SB 39, from PILF's perspective, requires the development of annual practices to assess faulty or outdated voter registration records, such as those who are deceased, convicted of felonies, registered subsequently out of Alaska, are foreign nationals, or other cases where eligibility can be questioned. The Division of Elections will also need to regularly supply disclosures involving data breaches and voter registration totals relative to eligible population. You've probably heard of this issue, not just in Alaska going back years, but also around the country, this issue of bloated voter rolls. Alaska has a part in this problem, and SB 39 is designed to attack that problem. These are common sense measures regularly seen in the lower 48 states, and Alaska is a part of a slim minority of states which has held more registered voters than eligible adults of voting age per the U.S. Census stretching back nearly a decade now. And let's be very clear on what that means. If you were to take a look at Alaska's total population, everyone 18 and older, and just engage in a bit of magical thinking, and that everyone that's 18 and older in Alaska is not a U.S. citizen, is not a felon, they are absolutely eligible to vote, you still would have more registered voters than that number that the U.S. Census has on record. And really, there's only other one state in the union that has had that problem, and that's Kentucky. SB 39 follows a clear roadmap for voter roll maintenance updates while also envisioning necessary guardrails to make certain that unforced errors and bad data matches do not complicate the process. SB 39 outlines the controls needed to snuff out false positives in the maintenance process. And this is important because what we're talking about here in terms of these best practices is you taking Alaska's voter data and comparing it against other typically government data sources, such as the National Change of Address System, the Social Security Death Index. There's mention in the bill about utilizing the membership with the Electronic Registration Information Center, otherwise known as ERIC. So Alaska is spending taxpayer dollars to subscribe, essentially, to these data sources. And what the bill sets out is that you're not just going to go through and try and match all of the John Browns and assume that this data is trustworthy. No, the bill requires that you can't just match names. We want to be able to make sure that we are matching Social Security numbers against Social Security numbers, driver's license numbers against driver's license numbers. We want to make sure that we're doing this in a scientific way to avoid false positives. Because if you don't, you're only going to invite other legal headaches later on whenever people are presumed to be dead, but they actually aren't. So if any lawmaker wants to see that these best practices can work, all you're willing to do is take a look at Kentucky. Because for just about the same timeline here in terms of looking at voter registration data, Kentucky has strikingly similar problems to Alaska, where they had more registered voters than people apparently living there that were of voting age, according to the U.S. Census. But these same best practices that SB 39 sets out for voterless maintenance have been put into place in previous years in Kentucky, and the results are speaking for themselves. I'll leave you with this one concern here. Given Alaska's recent experiences with cyber intrusions and its history of unkempt voter rolls, if the time ever came where another cyber attack sought to do actual damage to the voter data, how could you tell the difference between prior negligence in list maintenance versus fresh sabotage if you have these best practices working for you already? For this reason, we believe that Alaska needs SB 39 now, and I want to thank you on behalf of the Public Interest Legal Foundation for this invitation to testify today. Thank you.
Committee members, any questions of Mr. Churchwell? Seeing none, thank you, sir, for your invited testimony and being succinct. Next, we've closed invited testimony. We're going to open public testimony. Public testimony is now open. We're going to start in Juneau in the room. Do we have a Colleen Evans? Pardon? Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and we're going to keep it to a hard 2 minutes, please, for your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. It's Colleen Ivanko. I'm from Juneau. I live in Auk Bay. I wanted to thank each and every one of you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for all of your hard work. I am a concerned citizen of Juneau. I'm a parent. I'm an employee. I'm a business owner. I volunteer in this community. I care about my community. I care about the state that I live in. I want to see transparency. I want to see transparency in this. I want to see transparency in schools. I want to see transparency in support and trust in all of you. I am here to show you that I care. I care about this. I'm not going away. I'm raising my kids in this community and in this state, and they're born and raised in this state. They will be leaders. I'm raising them to be leaders in this state. I want other parents to do that as well. And I want to be able to take care of my children knowing that I don't have to come here to make sure that we are all doing our job with transparency. This is going to offer us the option of transparency. I urge you to support this, and I want it passed. And I am going to continue to keep eyes on this and other things. And if we have to come and show up and introduce ourselves and say, what can we do for you so that we can support you to do a good job, we will do it, and that's why I'm here. So I urge you to pass open source voting so that we can sleep at night and know that we are doing what we need to do and not be here as well. So thank you so much for your time. We appreciate you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Rich Anderson. I believe Mr. Anderson's in the room. And Mr. Anderson, put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, my name is Rich Anderson. I'm a resident of Juneau, and I'm here to represent myself. I'm urging you to move, after you hear testimony today, to pass this out of committee with an affirmative. We need to fix the system. You know, we just need to regain trust in the system on a statewide, and we all know about the federal level since like 2000 or whatever. It seems like every election cycle we have nothing but, you know, troubles and stuff, and nobody's ever happy. But, you know, it's a black eye, you know, and every vote, you know, legitimate votes needs to be counted. And, you know, transparency, like some what we'd heard earlier in some of the testimony, transparency is paramount with this process. It needs from the beginning to the end, you know, no broken links in the chain. For the state of Alaska, this election cycle is unprecedented. You know, we've got four elections coming up. We got two of them for Don Young's seat, right? And we've got, we got our primaries and we've got the regular state elections after that. Okay, we've got 19 senators and 40 reps that are going to be voted on, which is pretty good. That on top of that, we've got ranked choice voting, you know, so that's a whole nother thing. This election cycle is going to open up probably a lot of can of worms. I'm looking at this bill, you know, to maybe help minimize some of the stuff that's been going on, because like I say, for years we've been hearing different things. You know, to me, this bill helps keep the honest people honest. It's a good bill. I've looked through it, and it's pretty good. You know, there's probably, you know, who knows, maybe there's some tweaks or whatever. You guys will work that out. But basically, you know, it's just, wouldn't it be great if assuming this bill gets passed through and moved on into a general, you know, becomes law or whatever, wouldn't it be great if this bill helped minimize some of the things from the past cycles and help make things better? Like I say, I just look at this specific election cycle as being a real, really big one because there's so much going on. And anyway, I just wanted to kind of thank you and encourage you to vote affirmative on this and move it out of committee.
Thank you. Thanks. Cindy Fuller. Welcome to Senate Finance. Please put yourself on the record, and I'll start the timer when you introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Cindy Fuller. I live in Juneau, Alaska. I'm a parent, a business owner, and a voter. I registered to vote when I was 18. At 23, I served in a precinct for voting during an election. I took voter ID and compared the ID to the person who was voting, had them sign their name, and gave them their ballot. In the last two elections, we've really changed what we're doing here. My ballot didn't count in the first mail-in election. My signature didn't match. I signed my voter registration when I was 18. I'm not 18 anymore, and I don't sign my signature the same. I had no recourse. I couldn't vote in person. I had to send a mail-in. So the next election, we had two precincts open in Juneau, one in the valley and one downtown. I stood in line for 45 minutes. There was 18 people in front of me. I had my ballot. I made the person look at my ID and sign on the outside of my ballot that I was the person giving them the ballot. My ballot counted. I shouldn't have had to do that. I would prefer to vote in person. Mail-in voting is not realistic. I support this bill. I have reservations. I feel it doesn't go far enough. There are things that need to be corrected. One is get rid of the machines. We don't need machines to count our ballots. We can do a backup with people, and there's plenty of places to make sure there's not damages done. So I say vote yes, and then look at it again next year.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your volunteerism at the voter precincts. Mr. Fuller, I believe you're up next. Welcome to Senate Finance.
My name is Steve Fuller. I'm a resident of Juneau. I've lived here since 1957. Chairman Bishop and Senators, thank you for your time. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I don't want to take too much of your valuable time, so I won't. I'm here in support of SB 39, hopefully to allow more trust and transparency in voting. I hope you will support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we're going to go to Rebecca Dundor, I believe, is in the room. Rebecca, if you could come forward and put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Dundor. Live in Juneau for the last 8.5 years or so. And just want to be here to say thank you for hearing this, and please do something, because this voting situation is really scary right now. And I and my family, we want to see something done. And like Cindy said, I don't think maybe this is quite enough, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. And I appreciate all of your hard work on this. Thank you.
Thank you for coming out today to testify. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Daryl Harmon. Mr. Harmon, could you bring yourself to the table and put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please?
Hello. I'm Daryl Harmon. Most of my life I've lived in Juneau, so I'm a resident. I vote. I'm in support of Bill 39 or any bill that's going to help secure the election and the election results so there's less question about whether the voting is fair and the outcome is fair. This is a process, I understand. So I don't know if it's Bill 39 that's going to do it or what, but I strongly encourage that. Just an anecdotal thing. Nobody's going to learn anything from this anecdotal idea, but if we are susceptible to being hacked by our competitors in Russia, which theoretically hack our internet pretty openly to sway people's viewpoints further away and dissect, you know, our country against each other for the effects of chaos. And they can do that with our voting system, and they're going to not sway one side or the other in particular, no favorism, but just for the maximum chaos effect. So I think both parties are should be equally interested in fixing this problem.
Thank you, Mr. Harmon, for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to our distance delivery online folks. We're going to go to Fairbanks, actually North Pole. Barbara Tyndale, if you could put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please proceed.
Thank you very much for taking testimony today. I really appreciate it. My name is Barbara Tyndale. I live in North Pole, and I'm representing myself. And I also want to thank Senator Showers and all those who sponsored this bill. And for the last 2 years, I have been extremely active in my district, going door to door and calling folks. And I can tell you, absolutely, there is great distrust among the population on our election system and what's going on in elections. And I'm really encouraging people to get out and try to fix this. And I appreciate all of those who have testified today and those experts who have talked about being able to see what's going on. We need that transparency. I too think we need to ban our electronic elections equipment. There's no trust in them. They seem to be very vulnerable. Paper and pencil ballots, we are a very small state. It'd be very easy to count. I work in precincts. I'm a precinct worker, and we could easily count the ballots that come to our precinct. And also ballot harvesting illegal, so many of the things that are in this bill. So I just want to say that we need to reestablish voter integrity in the state of Alaska. We need to fix our voter rolls, and I strongly support this bill, and I thank you again, Senator Showers, for your efforts on our behalf. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara. Next, we're going to go to Gene Holt in Palmer. Gene, can you hear us, and could you put yourself on the record, please, and 2 minutes of testimony?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. My name is Jean Holt, and I'm from Palmer, Alaska. I am representing myself and my husband, Harry Holt. I would like to thank the co-chairs, Bishop and Stedman, and the members of the Senate Finance Committee to comment on SB 39. After following the current SB 39 version over the last several years of the pros and cons on Alaskan elections, the only just outcome should be the support and passage of SB 39, especially in the present day of the election process questioned by many Alaskan voters. SB 39 updates Alaska's decades-old election statutes, not voter suppression of voters' rights or voter-by-mail system. The narrative scare tactics by opposition to SB 39. SB 39 addresses all aspects of our election system, voter data, security standards, and chain of custody of voter registration roll accuracy by restoring confidence in our election process to Alaskan citizens. SB 39 is the bill that brings integrity back to Alaska's elections. Support SB 39. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Holt, thank you very much for that testimony. Next, we're going to go to Moose Creek in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, Ms. Shelley Shoup, can you hear us, and could you put yourself on the record, please, in 2 minutes?
I can hear you just fine. My name is Shelley Shoup, and I'm calling representing myself and my husband, Kenneth Shoup, from Moose Creek. I am calling to urge you to please, please support SB 39. I know that much has been stripped from this bill, but it's a good and actionable start to start to correct the problems that we have in our election systems. It shouldn't matter your politics. This should be important to each and every voter in our state and in our country. We've got to clean up our voter rolls. We've got to get rid of ballot harvesting. And we must move away from mail-in ballots. We must. I just appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of SB 39. and thank you for the opportunity.
Ms. Shoup, thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Murray Walsh here in Juneau. Murray, can you hear us? And if you can, put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Murray Walsh. I live in Juneau in District 4. I am the chair of the District 4 of the Alaska Republican Party. I'm calling to reinforce the comments made on this bill, or the CS for SB 39, by Randy Rudrick. I have sent to the chair a message from Randy that explains the problems we have with the CS. So I'm not going to belabor it, other than to say a couple things. One is the change for, or the provision for same-day registration is going to burden election workers tremendously if a lot of people try and do it. So I think that's when you look at what's required, I think we should expect voters to be able to register 30 days before the election. The second thing is, there may be a code, but if it's written in a language that I cannot read, then it's not open to me at all. And I think, as other callers have said, we want this to be transparent, and I don't think we're there yet, because if I can't understand it, then it's not transparent. So I'd ask you to reconsider the CS and either put it on the table for a more complete, comprehensive fix that involves fixing the ballot measure 2 system, or set it aside until it can be worked out with more confidence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Randy Rudrick. Mr. Rudrick, can you hear us and put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please?
Thank you, sir. This is Randy Rudrick in Anchorage, Alaska. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak at this hearing today to the members of the Senate Finance Committee. I thank you very much for this opportunity. The current committee substitute for SB 39 has several issues that I want to address. First of all, it is completely silent on modifying the PFD automatic voter registration issue. The Division of Elections has requested an opt-in provision be adopted for this method of registration. I urge that the bill be amended to repair this oversight. The only thing that we're seeing out of this at this time, our turnout numbers are dropping with the inclusion of thousands of highly inactive voters. We need to address this issue. Secondly, as Mr. Walsh said, I oppose same-day registration. I view it as the front door to any low election integrity operation. I have a specific concern about a component of this legislation related to four-year absentee applications. This concept has haunted us before. Roughly a decade ago, only 11% of the highly aged 2-plus-year-old applications resulted in a ballot being returned to the Division of Elections. Yes, 89% of all of the ballots mailed out did not come back. This is an unacceptable process, and Alaskans have the right to vote absentee when they're pursuing things that require them to be in a unique location, different from their traditional home. Higher education, family issues, short-term training, temporary employment, military postings. We cannot send a piece of paper, a ballot, to somebody who is highly mobile 2 years after they provide it and believe that that's going to work. Furthermore, the CS wants to prohibit any infilling of an absentee ballot application. Assisting Alaska voters in completing an application and filing it timely allows them to vote. anything to prevent this is a simple act of voter suppression.
Mr. Rudrick, can you wrap up, please, sir? You're over your 2 minutes.
One minor item. The
please.
Tabulators that we have been used in 4 recounts in this year and have been verified to be correct. Let's make sure we have trustworthy equipment to replace them before we require a rapid change to something that is not tested. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. We're going to go to Glenn Allen. Charles Perrett, please, and if you can hear us, sir, put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, my name is Charles Perrett, live in Glen Allen, Alaska, 65-year-old resident here. I want to thank Mr. Logan Churchwell and Mr. Rowe for their testimony. You know, my question is, who wouldn't want transparency, and who wouldn't want honesty in elections? And so I strongly support SB 39. I, like others, have testified. Don't believe it may not go far enough. but I can tell you, for myself and my wife and my circle of friends, our number one concern is election integrity. And we don't feel we have it now. My circle of friends and myself, we have very, very little confidence in the system as it stands right now. And it affects our supporting candidates. I mean, why should we give money to a candidate if we feel the system is rigged? And we do feel it has been rigged, and it has been abused and misused. So I support SB 39. I think that it doesn't go far enough. One of the things I saw on there was that it still wants to make it a misdemeanor for ballot harvesting. That's an attack against our democracy. Now, we have people in Washington, D.C. that have been locked up for 2 years now without a trial for demonstrating. And we're going to turn ballot harvesting into a misdemeanor. It doesn't go far enough. We need to get really tough on those that are tampering and messing with our election system, because that is a true attack on democracy. I think if we don't do something to fix our elections and do it fast, I think that our very democracy is at stake. So thank you for allowing me to testify, and I just want to thank Senator Showers for all the work that he's done trying to bring transparency and honesty back to our elections. I'm done.
Thank you, sir. Next, we're going to go to Anna McKinnon, Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Ms. McKinnon, please put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Director. Good afternoon. Anna McKinnon, the Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Mr. Chairman, I'm on the line to answer questions, not to provide public testimony. Thank you so much.
All righty. Charlie Franz in Homer. Mr. Franz, can you hear us?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please proceed. Yes. 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, sir, for allowing me to testify. This is Charlie Franz. I'm a resident of Homer. I just wanted to testify in support of Senate Bill 39. I am not completely satisfied that it has everything in it that it needs, but it's a major step forward. I encourage you to move it out of committee so that it can be voted on and passed into law. The legislature needs to do whatever they can to reinstitute the confidence of Alaska citizens in our election process. Thank you very much, and I hope you'll act positively on the bill.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Tyndall in North Pole. We're back to North Pole again. Mr. Tyndall, can you hear us in 2 minutes, please?
This is Gary Tyndall in North Pole, representing myself. I'm glad to see that this bill is finally up for hearing and public comment. I'm convinced, along with many others here in the interior, that the integrity of our election process has been compromised and that the process is in need of reform. Specifically, we need to return to in-person voting and get rid of the Dominion and similar electronic devices. We need to eliminate mail-in voting, ballot harvesting, automatic voter registration, and early voting. Elections should occur on election day, not be spread over weeks. Absentee voting should be restricted to specific categories where in-person voting is not possible, such as for deployed military personnel and for those legitimately disabled. Voter registration lists need to be rebuilt from the ground up. And we need to return to a constitutionally sound basis for vote counting, where the candidate with the most votes wins, and there is no artificial threshold and no ranked choice voting shell game to determine a winner. This is what's needed, and I hope the final bill will address each of these points. I support and applaud Senator Schauer's efforts to restore election integrity and voter confidence in our election process, and I hope you will too.
Thank you, Mr. Tindall. All right, now we're going to go to Herman Morgan in Antioch. Mr. Morgan, can you hear us? And please put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me okay?
We can, Mr. Morgan.
Yeah, my name is Herman Morgan from Antioch, and speaking for myself, for a lot of us in rural Alaska who don't know what's going on in the capital law, you know, elections have consequences, and stolen elections have consequences too. And there's laws like, there's laws against gerrymandering, voter fraud, and election tampering. Anybody want to ask a governor, a lieutenant governor, and director of elections why they're authorizing vote by mail with no ID? You know, ask them what's the reason. Before they said it's because of COVID, but that's over. And say that more. Even you guys sitting there too, you think it won't affect you, but it will affect you. They mentioned foreign nationals voreting. There's millions of foreigners flooding across the border to give them tickets. How many are being sent to Alaska? 10,000? Are they going to vote too? Maybe that's a Dems plan to get enough votes, but, you know, they should be questioned about. They need to go back to not to mail-in voting and send them a voter registration card asking if they want a ballot, because this is not being held accountable. It's going to be over by next election. It'll be too late. I read what it says in the Bible, you know, seems like we're being plundered of our PFD, we're being plundered of our state, we're being plundered of our election. I'll read what it says in Isaiah 10. Woe to those who decree unrighteous decrees, who write misfortune, which they have prescribed, to rob the needy of justice and take what is right from the poor of my people, that widows may be their prey, and that they may rob the fatherless. What will you do in the day of punishment, and in a generation which come from afar? To whom will you plead for help, and where will you leave your glory? Without me they will bow down among the prisoners, and they shall fall among the slain.
Mr. Morgan, can you please wrap up? You're over your 2 minutes.
God, ask Christ Jesus for guidance. He said, listen to these Alaska leg and these other people, because Austin is about to fall. We're being invaded and we're being robbed of election. You guys got to stand up the whole of.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Morgan. Next, we're going to Ann Lucas, the National Federation of the Blind in Anchorage, Alaska. Ms. Lucas, can you hear us?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Bishop and committee members. My name is Bonnie Lucas, and I am from Anchorage, and I'm representing the National Federation of the Blind and myself. As the president of the National Federation of the Blind of Alaska, and as a person with a disability, I am blind, and I would like to give public testimony today regarding Senate Bill 39. As you consider election reform, it is imperative that legislators consider absentee digital voting options for people with disabilities. I am blind and have a blind adult child. Casting a private and secure ballot has been challenging, to say the least. A digital option would completely solve the difficulties we have experienced. I will just quickly say they range from a signature not being recognized and a ballot not being counted to going to the election place and not being able to, taking an hour and a half to use the machines, which are very much needed when people who are blind or have other disabilities go to vote. We are citizens too and need these accommodations. So I hope you will take these things into consideration as you make decisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to go back to the room. Ms. Lisa Ward, are you in the room? And would you bring yourself forward and put yourself on the record in 2 minutes of testimony, please?
Good afternoon. Lisa Ward, Juneau, Alaska. I am here representing myself and my family. I have several children that are of voting age, and I'm trying to teach them that it is imperative to take an interest in this subject. I think that there's a deep mistrust of the system, and I think it should be a bipartisan issue that people, no matter who you are or what your beliefs are, should want an open source, clear election. I think it's very important that we have a chain of custody, a ballot chain of custody. And I also think that it's incredulous to me that PFD rolls are used for voter registration when, as I understand it, you do not need to be a U.S. citizen to collect the PFD. So I think that you need to be a citizen to be a voter, and I think that there might be some muddy waters there. So I don't think that should be how you register to vote. I think that we need to make sure we have our open voting polling stations. I think we should encourage people for in-person voting. An ID needs to be required. It is ridiculously simple to get an ID at this point. Everybody has them. If you need an ID to get a beer, you should be required to have an ID to vote. It is very important to me. I think we should get rid of ranked choice voting. It is so incredibly difficult. I've had it explained to me, and I'm terrified of the upcoming election. And I think that we should be able to count our own votes. There's not that many of us in town, and we can get volunteers to have bipartisan representation to count the votes in our district. I don't think they should be sent out of town, and I think we should get rid of the machines. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we're going to go to Robert Welton in Douglas. Mr. Welton, can you hear us in 2 minutes, please?
Yes, I can hear you. So thank you. I'm Robert Welton, representing myself. I support the broad goals of SB 39 version E to make it easy to vote but hard to cheat. But there are two bad ideas that I'd like to see taken out of the bill. First, Section 36 requires absentee voters to reapply for an absentee ballot every 4 years. People have valid reasons for wanting to vote by mail, so the state shouldn't restrict this right unless there's compelling evidence of fraud. The Division of Elections has testified on the record that there was no significant fraud in the 2020 election. The Department of Law testimony pointed out that if a significant number of absentee ballots were fraudulently cast, we'd see an increase in duplicate ballots. No increase in duplicate ballots were seen. This mathematically proves that there was no significant fraud in absentee voting, or we would have seen duplicates. The second bad idea that I see here is requiring signature verification on all absentee ballots. Right now, signatures are only verified if there's something suspicious and the system works. Section 38 and 39 of this bill would require signature verification on all absentee ballots. This bill would open up, in my opinion, a back doorway to selectively reject absentee ballots, and is a bad idea. After a similar law was passed in Texas, up to 12% of absentee ballots were rejected statewide, but some precincts in Texas had rejection rates over 22%. Before the law, less than 1% of Texas absentee ballots were rejected. We don't want to open a back door to this kind of thing in Alaska. It could be abused. So those are the two provisions that really stand out as bad, the broad provisions, I think, on increasing security, on auditing and open source code. I've come to accept all those as good ideas. But these two areas here, I would seriously ask you to amend out. Thanks for your attention, and thanks to all of you for your service to the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Next, we're going to Ann Brown in Anchorage. Ann, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and 2 minutes of testimony, please. Ann, you might want to unmute your phone.
Thank you. My name is Ann Brown, and I'm testifying for myself. I wanted to thank you, Senator Bishop, for the opportunity for me to ask that the proposed statute's prohibition on any pre-filled information on absentee ballot applications be removed. Efforts to assist Alaskan voters with some pre-filled information on an absentee ballot application, which is taken from the existing voter file, increases the likelihood that the voter will complete and return the application accurately and in a timely manner, receive an absentee ballot, and vote. Preventing a useful tool such as some pre-filled information on an absentee ballot application would not aid the cause of election integrity. I also want to suggest that the deletion of the witness signature requirement on an absentee by mail ballot envelope is not a good idea. The witness signature requirement has always been considered an important way to help verify a voter's identity and greatly aids in the cause of election integrity in Alaska. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're gonna go to Cheng Shecho and Matt Su. Cheng?
Hi, my name is Cheng Shecho. I'm from the National Bureau. I would like to thank all you senators for taking the time to hear this bill and to hear my voice. I want to show support for the SB 39. Because I feel like election integrity is very important, you know, especially for America to, you know, in Alaska, just the recent 2020 election, I felt like my vote didn't count. And I just want to be able to, show in the vote system. So, thank you for taking the time, and I hope you support the passion of SB 39.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to go to Mr. Ray Craig in Anchorage. Mr. Craig, can you hear us? And please put yourself on the record.
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Yeah, please start. 2 minutes.
I'm part of an informal group looking at election integrity reforms here in Anchorage. I oppose CSSB 39 if it stays in the form presented. For clarity, my copy is labeled in the upper right 32LS0204/E. I talked to Senator Schauer's policy advisor and understand that this is still a work in progress, but as is, it does not do the job needed and is not acceptable. Specifically, one, same-day registration. We can't have this as described. It's an invitation to fraud. Two, eliminating witness signature. There is little current confirmation of witness signatures or any requirement for an ID, but blanket elimination is troubling unless there's another way to confirm ballot legitimacy. Three, four-year absentee ballot is recreated. This is a failed concept and should not be brought back. It's been described, the issues, by others, so I'll skip the four. Routine forensic exams. Is there a definition for what this is in case law or the statutes? It looks like it might not have any teeth in it. Five, PFD automatic voter registration. I don't see this in the CS. This has to be ended, or at most must be an opt-in procedure only. The legislature has to act to fix this ballot initiative mistakes. Please do not pass CSSB 39. It needs further work. Thank you.
Thank you. Carol Cooper, Soldotna. Carol, can you hear us? And please put yourself on the record in 2 minutes.
Yes, I do hear you. My name is Carol Cooper. I live in Soldotna. Been in Alaska for 40 plus years, and have my children and grandchildren all here on the Kenai. I am representing myself, and I have been very concerned about election integrity, especially since the 2020 election. And I believe that this Senate Bill 39 is a good start to correct the problems. And so I just encourage a positive vote for Bill 39. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Juneau, Kathy Swanson. If you can hear us, put yourself on the record, please, in 2 minutes.
Kathy Swanson from Juneau, representing myself and my husband. Thank you for taking public testimony. As far as what people prior to me said, the mail-ins, I know half a dozen people had the same problem. They were rejected. These are people that have been voting since they were 18 years old, like myself. And you can't imagine the anger as hearing that their ballot just wasn't counted and there was no adjudication process or anything they could do about it. I am strongly against any type of mail-in election. It's just rife with fraud. I myself, the first time, got 6 ballots for a 2-voter household. None of these other ballots were names I had ever even heard. The next go-round, I got 4 extras again, but I had known two of them were our adult children who are not living here. So they're registered where they're living to vote. This last go-around, I only got 2 extras, and one of them I actually knew. So that was an improvement. But absentee ballots have always been fine, and they are fine. You need to request them, and you need to be on the voter rolls. Same-day registration is horrible. That should not be allowed anywhere. And any of this automatic, at least I know at the DMV, they do ask you if you'd like to register to vote. The PFD has been such a sore subject, I can't even remember what was on the application, or if you're just automatically. Anything like this, that is just not appropriate for elections. And basically, that's all I have to say. So thank you again for taking public testimony, and have a lovely day.
Thank you for your testimony. Linda Newman in Juneau. Linda, can you hear us? And if you can, put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Hello. Thank you. This is Linda Newman. I'm in Juneau, and I appreciate you taking my testimony. I am a person with low vision, which means, one, I cannot drive to the polling booth. 2, I cannot read the standard ballot. 3, I use digital access to, like, large print to read things to me. I want to, on behalf of myself, Bonnie Lucas, who mentioned that from Anchorage, folks with vision loss and other disabling conditions to be considered citizens that have the right to vote as well. So it's important to me that digital access be considered if this goes to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Brent Turner says California here. Mr. Turner, if you can hear us, 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you very much, my good friends in Alaska. My name is Brent Turner. Some consider me an expert in the field of election system security and technology, and I just wanted to call up and thank you for your consideration and hopeful hopefully your passage of this particular SB 39. What is exciting to myself and those involved in election system security is the heightening of the security and the reduction of your costs for these systems, and I'm understanding that you are considering open source technology rather than proprietary or what we call secret software systems. By leading on this issue, you will set a wonderful tone for the security of not only Alaska, but the United States. We've been trying to get California to pick up the ball. We've had some success in New Hampshire with the disabilities components being open source and to the standard of the blind associations, and that's great news. And now in Mississippi, they are utilizing the transparent software code systems rather than the ones that are being sold by the current vendors. So applause to you, and I hope this moves forward. We're very much in support and rooting for the great state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike Swain, Anchorage. Mike, would you put yourself on the record in 2 minutes?
Hello.
Hello. 2 minutes, please.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that I believe we should have less government and less tabulation. The big deal is you have to have your vote counted. And what it seems to me is that you just got a bunch of people that's farming off information. They want personal information that's valuable, and really you need to be counting the votes and have a single regulatory body, the election people doing that, not a whole big bunch of government with a bunch of databases that you have to actually replicate your data to begin with to get a count on the information. It would be seem pretty easy to have just the election division take care of that and leave it at that, but this is involving a whole bunch of other government stuff, and I wanted to say that the outside signature on those mail-in ballots really, it's a clear violation of privacy. They're going through the mail. Everybody sees them. I mean, you could just look at that and see. And another thing is the idea of felons and felonies. That law is, like, intentionally vague. They're different between different states. The people culminating this data have different laws in different states. And I mentioned that in the early 80s, Senator Day O'Connor was up here, and she stated that, you know, pretty much anybody could run for office, but we have separation of powers, and the elected bodies need to be making the law, not a regulatory body that's forcing conformity without the law. And the forms are not standardized. When you're doing this automated voter thing, you go to the DMV, the form is different than the form from the PFD. And you know right away those are different regulatory bodies created by law to do the things that you made that law to do. So I just think this is just another big government. They're trying to put that electronic stuff across on you. We need rights and electronic data. We need to make that felony thing a little bit less intentionally vague. And I've written a little stuff here. Pretty much you need law for those, not a regulatory body, taking everybody's data, saying it's law, and standardize the forms, and use less government. We just need to count the vote and keep everybody's stuff private.
Mike, could you put your name on the record again for our Senate records?
Mike Swain.
Thank you, Mike. Next, we're going to go to Marlene Moto Carl in Deering. Marlene, if you can hear us, can you put yourself on the records in 2 minutes, please?
Good afternoon. I was just concerned about this last statewide election begin the primary. Usually we have enough people working, four of them, and I end up being the only worker here the whole day as an election worker. Usually before election, that when in the morning I'd run around with my Honda and pick up the workers, and according to NOM election office, we are not supposed to leave our ballots at the see the building when we vote alone. And people all day trip at the city office IRA in the same place where we have elections. And they keep calling and trying to look for help for me to work with me. And in the end, toward the end of the day, one of the workers helped me count the ballots. And I'm going on like 20 years working as a election judge here in Deering through state of Alaska and local and borough wide. And anyway, I find it kind of amusing that same day in August, the young voters were coming along. They were looking for a local option. I tell them we don't have them till October or November. And a person running on this first time, and he's not too familiar to be on the statewide ballot. I think he caused a lot of commotion back then. And I would like to see something somewhere that if it was legal for me to be the only one working, because I will do it again. And I only job I like and I can get, because I like the young people to work on the other job openings. Additional job. And other concern I have is it legal for the city local elections to be run the same day in the same office, same election, because it's hard to find workers that day that could work if they do their election properly. This election, they didn't do it properly. I turned it away. It had a local option law with nothing in place for public notice.
Marlene, thank you for your testimony. Can you wrap it up?
We have that election.
Can you please wrap up your testimony? Thank you. And we want to thank you from the table for your public service for over the last 20 years, manning that division of elections. It's a big job in the bush. We understand that. Thank you. We're going to go to Kelly Nash in Fairbanks. Kelly Nash, if you can hear us, put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Hi, my name's Kelly Nash. I'm from Fairbanks. I am the founder of Interior Patriots. And I just want to say how absolutely I am appalled at the amount of fraud that has already happened just in the last couple of days with these absentee ballots that got mailed out to absolutely everybody. People that have moved and have been registered in other states for 7 years. People at Pioneer Home who are incoherent that they called the Division of Elections to say, hey, they can't sign this ballot. What should they do? What should we do? And they said, go ahead and fill it out for them, send it in. Misprints, envelopes that won't close. I didn't want an absentee ballot. I think this is a recipe for disaster, and anyone that calls up from California and applauds this, that, you know, this whole entire mess we have, kind of proves the issue. Interior Patriots, we were able to get ranked choice voting kicked out of our borough, and we all know what's going to happen. The fact that these elected officials that don't want these fair elections, which is one candidate, one vote, paper ballots, hand count, you know, I can't wait until you're all voted out. I can't wait until you're gone. And I'm really hoping that it's this year, because our elections need to be safe and secure, unlike our 2020 elections, which was not. Have a great day.
You're welcome. Thank you. This closes public testimony. Anyone else in the room listening to testify? Seeing none, we're finished with online public testimony is now closed. Senator Schauer, wrap up.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Schauer, District E. I was going to have a minute or so, but based on time, and I know that you have a lot going on, I'm just going to stop and not do that. I just wanted to say thank you for getting us on the docket today, so I'm going to defer for later just because I know you're busy. Thank you.
You will be back. Thank you. We're going to take a brief at ease.
come back on the record. Thanks, everybody, for their patience. We're now going to take up Senate Bill 164, the operating budget, followed by House Bill 281, the operating budget. Then we're going to go on to House Bill 282, the mental health budget. And then we'll have a presentation or conversations with Mr. Painter, the legislative finance director. I'd like to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 164, the capital budget. So Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 164, version O, as our working document.
And I'll object for discussion. Mr. Rusendorf, would you want to come to the table? You're already here. Introduce yourself for the record. Tell us who you work for, and then take us through the changes, please.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Cody Grusendorf. I'm staff to the Senate Finance Committee and Senator Bishop. A brief explanation of the changes to version O of Senate Bill 164. This version incorporates all the amendments that were adopted by the committee on yesterday, May 2nd, and it fixes one technical drafting error. There was an incorrect reference in Section 30D on page 72, line 6. It incorrectly cited Section 1, and this corrects it to Section 4.
Okay.
Those are the changes.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the committee substitute. Do we have further objection?
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have objection, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things we had was yesterday where there was a number of amendments that were passed. There were a number of amendments that did not pass. What are the plans for the ones that did not pass?
Can you repeat that, please? You want to know the amendments that did not pass?
Yeah, what's going to happen to the amendments that did not pass? Are we going to be looking at those again because of the transpiration that's gone on in the other body? At ease, Mr. Chairman.
We'll have a brief at ease. Come back on the record. You, Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my objection.
Okay. Objection's been withdrawn. We have further objection to the adoption of the version O. It's a working document. Seeing none, version O is adopted as a working document. We'll go on now to House Bill 281, the operating budget. Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 281, Version K, as our working document.
And I'll object for discussion. Mr. Eklund, do you want to introduce yourself for the record, who you work for, and explain the changes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Peter Eklund, staff to Senator Stedman and the Senate Finance Committee. Mr. Chairman, Version K, the version in front of you, you may recall the last committee substitute we had in front of us, you had in front of you, was version L. The committee considered 29 amendments to version L, did not adopt them all, but the ones that were adopted have been added to version L, and thus you have version K in front of you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption. Version K is our working document. Do we have further objection on version K? Seeing none, version K is adopted. We'll go on. We'll continue working on House Bill 281. Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 281, version Y, as our working document.
And I'll object for discussion. Mr. Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Being passed out to you right now is version Y of the operating budget. And so, put simply, Mr. Chairman, what version Y is just merging the two committee substitutes that you just adopted, version O of the capital budget and version K of the operating budget. It's merging both of those documents into House Bill 281, version Y. So what you have in front of you, Mr. Chairman, in version Y is an omnibus appropriation bill that has capital items supplemental items, and also operating items, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions on version one? Other questions on version Y? Senator Wilikowski.
Yes, just to clarify, so this has everything, every amendment that we passed, there's just nothing else other than what we've already passed in this committee. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of version Y as a working document. Any further objection to version Y? Seeing none, version Y is our working document. I'd like to go ahead and ask for a fiscal update from Mr. Painter. If he can come forward, we'll have a brief at ease while he gets set up. We're at ease. Come back on the record, please. So we've passed out the version Y, the omnibus bill. We've also have reports in the back of both version O, version K, and then the combined version Y. We've also added in the back for a handout a little spreadsheet dealing with the school bond debt reimbursement to communities so the communities can see what those numerics are. That's handout D. We'll also be on legislative finance. They'll be posting more reports on the omnibus bill and other things. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and have Mr. Painter introduce himself for the record, tell the public who he is and what he does, and then walk us through a fiscal update summary of version Y in front of us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter. I'm the director of the Legislative Finance Division. And I was asked to give a fiscal update with the version of the budget that was just adopted. So start by reviewing where we are with oil prices a little bit, and then go into the a fiscal summary with the CS that was adopted. Talk about some of the areas where the operating budget grew and the position counts as well. So on slide three, we have an update on oil prices. We pulled these from the futures market yesterday. As you can see that the spring forecast is that red or orange line. It calls for $101 oil in FY23. As of the futures yesterday, we'd be looking at about $99. Similarly, for FY22, right now we're running about $2 under the forecast. So as we're kind of looking at the fiscal summary, it's very close to the spring forecast, but currently the futures are slightly below. But it's been obviously very volatile throughout the year.
We'll have a brief at ease. On the record, go ahead and continue, Mr. Painter.
All right, this next slide, slide four, shows the oil prices to date this fiscal year. You can see in the brackets, the DOR did the spring forecast in this period based on the futures in that week. Since then, prices have been extremely volatile, dipping down below $100 a couple of times and then going up to nearly $120 a barrel. So we've seen, you know, swings within a $20 band or so over the past couple of months. So again, as we're looking at these fiscal summaries, just keep in mind the level of volatility we see so far this year has been pretty high. Then the next slide shows a price sensitivity chart. So you can see as prices increase, obviously our revenue increases. The spring forecast was that $101 oil. Based on where the futures are now, we're down about $99 a barrel. That would be a reduction in revenue of about $190 million. There's, in DOR's forecast, there's a bit of a, there's sort of stair steps sometimes when certain companies are getting off, are moving in different parts of the tax system. So $100 to $101 is a bit of a stair step, so it's more than average. Generally, in this price range, it's about $90 per or $90 million per dollar of oil. But that, as you can see, that line is not a fixed curve. So depending on where you are, that's gonna be a different marginal difference. And you know, when we're trying to balance a budget with relatively high oil prices where we're depending on that rather than depending on savings accounts as we have in past years, legislative finance has historically recommended that the legislature use a sensitivity chart because you have a better idea of where you would be if prices do not meet the forecast expectation. You know, the forecast is really this line more than this one point. And we would encourage you to consider, you know, a wider stretch of the line than just looking specifically at $101 oil. This next slide, slide six, is a fiscal summary of the Senate finance budget, the CS that was just adopted. So on the top, we have the revenue projected to be just shy of $7 billion of unrestricted general fund revenue in FY22, about $8.3 billion in FY23. As we go down, you can see appropriations in line six. The operating budget in FY22, including supplementals, is about $4.9 billion and a bit over $5 billion in FY23. Agency operations, increased from year to year on line eight by $263.9 million. We'll talk a bit more about that number on a future slide, or 6.7%. We put a placeholder in here for the K-12 disparity test. There's still an ongoing concern that the state may fail the K-12 disparity test. There's an ongoing appeal on that with the Federal Department of Education. If we turn out to fail, that would add $72.4 million to our UJF expenditures in FY22, $74.6 million in FY23. And that may not come to pass. We may succeed in our appeal, but just to make sure we're on the conservative side and are budgeting for it, I was asked to include that in this fiscal summary, so that's line nine. Line 10 is the statewide items. There's an increase of $349 million from FY22 to 23. The primary cause of that increase is oil and gas tax credits. There was $54 million paid out in the FY22 budget and $349 million in this budget. The other major increase is a deposit to the retirement funds to make up for the zero funding of health care that by the ARM board. And again, we'll talk more about that item. There are a bit over $500 million of operating supplementals in this budget. The largest supplementals are the one that the chairman referred to, school bond debt reimbursement, paying back the past amounts that have been unpaid in previous years, as well as similarly with the REAA fund or Regional Education Attendance Area Fund that funds rural school construction, paying back the unpaid amounts in past years. As with, same with community assistance, making up for past vetoes to that to get to a $30 million distribution each year. And then also oil and gas tax credits, which went partially funded last year because of a failed CBR vote. That's also made up in the supplemental. So the primary items here are kind of making up for past years. There are also other increases relating to fire suppression and the disaster relief fund, among others. Line 12 shows the capital budget. So this year's capital budget, or this session's capital budget, is actually kind of split. So there's last year, there was $242.9 million of capital appropriations. This year, the capital budget split, where $324.6 million is in FY22, $407.4 million is in FY23. A lot of those are not really supplementals because they have to be. It's really just for balancing the books. So essentially, we're looking at a capital budget of about $730 million of general funds, or of unrestricted general funds, across the two fiscal years. Line 16 shows the permanent fund dividend. Last fall, there was about $1,100 dividend paid out. This year, this budget includes a dividend that's 50% of the percent of market value, which is estimated to be somewhere between $2,500 to $2,600 per person. And then line 18, this budget includes $199 million to deposit past unpaid royalties into the corpus of the permanent fund to make up for amounts that were not paid in FY17 and FY18. So where that leaves us is with a pre-transfer surplus in both years. In FY22, there's a pre-transfer surplus of about $550 million. In FY23, it's about $1.2 billion. One thing you may notice that's different from past fiscal summaries is we moved forward funding K-12 down to the fund transfers here in line 23. That's to be consistent with how legislative finance treated forward funding K-12 in the previous period that we forward funded. Since it's really a form of savings, it's moving money in and out of a savings account, even though when we don't forward fund, the public education fund behaves like a fund capitalization and would be up in this part of the fiscal summary. When we're forward funding, it's more appropriate to put it down below because it's a form of savings rather than a form of spending. So this leads to kind of a cleaner fiscal summary than the prior version. It doesn't look like that $1.2 billion is adding to your spending because it is a form of savings. So the bottom line here, in line 26, in FY22 is a post-transfer surplus of $832 million. There's also on the line above that $660 million that's being deposited in the statutory budget reserve. So combined, just shy of $1.5 billion expected to go into the statutory budget reserve in FY22. And then in FY23, there is a post-transfer surplus of $87.4 million that would similarly go into the statutory budget reserve. Where that leaves us is that in FY23, the budget balancing oil price is about $99 per barrel. So if prices are at least $100, then the amount above goes into the permanent fund here on line 22. If prices are below that, then that goes away. And so the budget balancing price would be about $99 a barrel. Also included in this budget, however, in the forward funding K-12, that amount will prorate downwards if the revenue isn't available. So the budget balancing oil price without forward funding drops down to $84 a barrel. And the next page, I'll show a fiscal summary at $84 a barrel, if there's no questions.
Okay, next page, please.
Okay, so this next page, slide 7, shows a fiscal summary at $84 a barrel oil, which is kind of the budget balancing point. So there's a few changes that would happen. One is in statewide items on line 10. The oil and gas tax credit amount would decrease because it's a formula based on oil revenue. So that would decrease to reduce expenditures if prices are lower. The next is on line 22, that over $100 oil deposit permanent fund, that would not happen. And then the forward funding K-12 would be just the amount possible. So at $84 oil, there would be $36 million extra put into forward funding, but essentially zeroed out. So that's roughly our expected budget balancing price this year.
And Mr. Painter, do we have, a lot of times we'll use
backfill or backstop language out of the CBR, the SBR. You want to explain that difference, please?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So a lot of times we will have language in the budget that if there is a deficit, then the difference is drawn out of the either the constitutional budget reserve, the CBR, that would require a three-quarter vote, or from the statutory budget reserve, which is a majority vote. And I believe that language is in this budget from the statutory budget reserve, but that would only kick in after forward funding went away. So it would only kick in below that $84 a barrel or so that would balance.
Okay. And can you maybe get back to the committee on what that oil price would be for the evaporation of forward funding and the evaporation of the statutory budget reserve, which has on this slide $1.5 billion in it?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I can get back to the committee with that number.
And then I'd also like a little bit of assistance for the committee men and myself and gal. There's a lot of issues we had increases in the FY23 budget that aren't going to be reoccurring for the FY24. So if you could get back to us a little bit on what FY24 would look like on the reoccurring basis, so we could see what our reoccurring escalation is, and maybe we can even have you try to put that in percentages, like we've had you, what you've done recently looking at the governor submitted budget and the budget we had coming off the table, so we can keep an eye on the rate of change from FY22 to FY23, and then what it looks like, what the base change increase would be for FY24.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I can provide that.
Okay, thank you. Other questions on this? Okay, we'll go on to the next slide, please.
All right, so the next few slides cover the major increases in this year's budget compared to the previous fiscal year. So the governor's budget called for several major increases, which are listed on this slide. The next couple of slides will cover increases in the Senate budget that were not in the governor's original budget. The largest increase in the governor's budget this year was $45 million to increase Medicaid. A lot of that is due to the expected expiration of an enhanced FMAP or federal medical assistance percentage that was through the pandemic. The next largest increase was adding unrestricted general funds to offset DGF funds that are not available this year because of the CBR sweep. That's primarily in the higher education fund. When that fund was swept, the about $22 million of expenditures that were coming from that fund were replaced with UGF in the governor's budget. There's about $25.5 million for contractual and other salary increases. So earlier in session, I think we had used a number of about $15.5 million. That's increased with the a couple of new contracts for the general government union and a couple others recently. There's also increases to health insurance and risk management costs across the budget. So these are kind of automatic changes, at least from the legislature standpoint, although the contractual things are negotiated. The governor included major increases in these next two departments, in both the Department of Public Safety and then the Department of Corrections. So in the Department of Public Safety, there's a number of increases that add up to a bit over $17 million. Adding a number of troopers, state troopers and wildlife troopers, village public safety officers, and increasing their pay and adding additional support positions. Then in corrections, nearly $13 million of increases. A lot of that is for a booking unit and a mental health unit at Highland Mountain Institution, and then adding a number of non-correctional officer support positions there as well.
Okay. Next slide.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, there's three more items if we...
Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there's $5.7 million for two items for DEC to take primacy of federal permitting programs, $4 million for the Department of Law for Statehood Defense, and then $3.8 million for fire suppression preparedness.
Okay. Did you have a question, Senator Bishop, or just flagging me because I got ahead of myself?
I just flagging you because you got ahead of yourself.
Okay. Now we'll go to the next page.
So, Mr. Chairman, this next slide shows the is kind of a repeat from a few weeks ago, but for the members of the public, many of the increases that were on that previous slide and some other smaller ones are reversing past budget reductions made over the past 7 or 8 years. So the Medicaid increase, the $45 million, comes a year after Medicaid had been reduced by $35 million. So a lot of that's just getting back to the FY21 levels of Medicaid funding. The University of Alaska received a $4 million increase, and the University of Alaska was increased or was reduced from FY20 to 22, and in fact before then by much more than that. There's a $2 million increase for legislative per diem, which was the governor's veto last year, as well as $700,000 of general fund mental health items that had been vetoed by the governor last year and are added back. There's other items in here that reverse reductions made in previous years under previous governors, so not just this governor, but just going back farther. So the 404 primacy that I mentioned in DEC, that was initiated in the legislature in FY14 budget and then cut in FY15. There is $3.8 million for the wildfire prevention in the academy. That academy had been cut in FY16, and there were other cuts to wildfire prevention that year. There have been reductions to village public safety officers. This is essentially an amount that was cut in FY16. There was also a cut in FY20 that was reversed in FY21. And then there's also $1.2 million for the judiciary for increased hours. That had been a cut back in FY16. So a lot of these items you're seeing as increases this year are really getting back to the levels of service that are provided before revenue declined starting in FY15.
Let's let him finish up the slide, and we've got a couple of questions. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, I'm done with the slide.
Okay. Senator Bishop and then Senator Olson.
I'd just like to put on the record on the university $4 million increase. You spoke on that line from about, I believe it was 16 or 17 to date. That's been a $101 million reduction at the University of Alaska.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, going back to page 8, you got the DEC primacy for federal permitting. I thought we had cut that money to them.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, that's not in the Senate version of the budget, but it was one of the increases that the governor had requested.
Oh, I see. Just want to make sure, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions on page 9 or slide 9? Okay, we'll go on to slide 10.
Mr. Chairman, slide 10 shows some of the larger increases in the Senate Finance Agency operations compared to the governor's budget. The largest is $60 million for K-12 schools outside the BSA, the base student allocation formula. The House had $57 million for the same item, so it's a similar number across both bodies, but that was not in the governor's budget. There's $59.4 million for the Alaska Marine Highway System. In the governor's budget, that there was no UGF for that purpose. Instead, it was funded entirely with federal funds. In both the House and Senate budgets, there's an amount of UGF that's equal to the amount of funding last year. So it's not really an increase compared to last year, but if you're comparing to the governor's budget, it does show up as an increase. There's a $27 million fuel trigger, as it's called, to offset high oil prices. So depending on the price of oil, an amount will be distributed by the Office of Management and Budget to state agencies to offset their higher fuel costs, particularly the Alaska Marine Highway. That $27 million reflects the cost if prices were $125 a barrel. If we were looking at prices more like $100 a barrel, as we discussed earlier, that would go down by $12 million. So that amount is $500,000 per dollar of oil above $70 a barrel. There's a $16.1 million increase in the Department of Health to increase personal care attendant wages. That was added by this body. The House has a similar item, but it's half that size. There's $14.1 million of increases for the University of Alaska. We mentioned the $4 million in the governor's budget, but this body had additional amounts. The Senate added $5 million for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute as a one-time item. There's $4.3 million, or as a multi-year, excuse me. There's $4.3 million for a food bank pilot program. That is a one-time item. And then there's a $4.3 million increase to K-12 residential schools, which is a 50% increase to those schools. And those are not Mount Edgecombe, but the other boarding schools funded by the state.
And just a quick note, you can maybe help me with the Marine Highway. I think these funds are put in there if they ran their schedule and we had high oil prices. it's probably a higher probability we'll have high oil prices than they will run their schedule, because I don't think they're going to have the crew to run it. So, and also it's backfill language, the general fund's backfill for the federal, so I would expect a lot of those funds never to be spent as we roll into next January and do the review. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, you're talking about the $60 million going to the Marine Highway system up there?
Yes.
Okay.
And there's, you know, we're sliding in, for those watching at home, we're sliding into a new era where we're going to have hopefully around $200 million of federal money coming into the Marine Highway. At least that's how much is available nationwide for Marine Highways, ferries, and I think we're the only one that qualifies. But we don't know the timing when it's actually going to be available and hit the Treasury and stuff. So we'll do that review next year and have a more refined number through next year's budget process. I'm not expected to be substantially less than this. Any other questions on page 10? Okay, go on to page 11, please.
All right, slide 11 shows increases in statewide items compared to the governor's proposal. And several of these are in FY22 and are items I already mentioned. So there's $89.3 million for the PERS pension funds. So the Retirement Management Board had decided that to not fund the healthcare side of the unfunded liability. That fund is showing up as overfunded currently, over 100% funding. And so the ARM Board decided to just not fund that, which reduced costs to the state. The Senate Finance budget instead puts that cost reduction that the state would have taken in, instead puts that into the pension fund, which remains unfunded. So instead of taking the savings for the state, we put it into the underfunded pension fund that would reduce future costs. There's the $1.2 billion we've mentioned for K-12 forward funding that would is essentially a savings item, because that money's not increasing expenditures, but it's putting money aside to spend in future years. There's $199 million to the permanent fund corpus that would satisfy an audit finding relating to FY17 and 18 royalties that did not go into the permanent fund. And then there's a number of these items that I briefly touched on earlier to pay items that were unfunded in previous years. So from FY17 to 21, the school bond debt reimbursement and the REAA fund were not fully funded. These amounts bring them back, increase equal the unfunded amounts across those fiscal years. Then in FY22, both oil and gas tax credits and community assistance were not fully funded. Those are brought back up to the statutory level, so the community assistance amount would allow $30 million to go out in each of FY22 and 23, and the oil and gas tax credits would be the amount needed to pay the statutory statutory amount in FY22.
Okay, any questions on this page? Me seeing none, we'll go on to page 12.
Mr. Chairman, slide 12. Talks about the true operating budget growth rate. So I mentioned a few back on the fiscal summary that agency operations were up 6.7%. That may be understating the true level of budget growth, because there were some built-in decreases before the budget work really got started. So the governor's budget, so those are listed on the right. So there were the changes in due to the retirement funds. Last year, the legislature passed a bill that moved a portion of retirement funding to agency operations. So when we had a more positive return year, that some of that savings happened in agency operations. The K-12 student count is projected to be down. That also decreases the funding level for the state, but without changing service levels. There's a removal of one-time items for last year. And then on the positive side, there's contractual changes. So in all, the baseline really before we started our budget work is $55.5 million below last year's level. So if we expected that, you know, no change in service levels at all, we would have a lower budget in FY23 than FY22. So if you do your comparisons to that baseline rather than to FY22, you get kind of a clearer picture of the growth. So the governor's budget, and I'm referring to this table here on the bottom right, the governor's budget grew by 2.5% above the baseline. However, a lot of that's kind of, again, less than it would be, because the governor had that nearly $60 million reduction for the Alaska Marine Highway System by using federal funds. And again, that's not really a service level, a change in service levels. So including that as a reduction probably hides the true growth rate in that budget. So if you had funded it at the level that the House and Senate did in UGF, the governor's growth rate would have been 4%. And so that's really more of a true picture of the growth rate in his budget submission. The House budget has a growth rate of 6.9% above the baseline, while the Senate finance budget in front of you has an 8.3% growth rate above the baseline. And one thing to note between the House and the Senate is that there were some governor's amendments between that time that increased the budget, notably $10 million for the general government union, as well as a few hundred thousand dollars for the infrastructure bill that were incorporated on the Senate side that the House didn't have. So it may exaggerate the level of difference between the two. But any of these, this is a significant growth rate after quite a few years of flat or declining budgets. But the Senate finance budget is right now a bit over $300 million beyond the baseline.
And just as another note, through the timing process, the governor, he submits his budget December 15th, and we go through the process starting in January. The House normally leads the calendar dealing with the operating budget, and then they pass it over to us, and then we do our work. There's quite a few amendments every year and adjustments that come in after the House is already done with their work, and our budget cycle stays open till the very last, picking up requested changes or amendments from the governor or labor negotiations, other issues like that. So just for those watching at home, we do not have the same start and stop date as the House. We basically bat cleanup, and unfortunately some things are left to us to pick up and deal with at the end of the cycle, the budgetary cycle. Any other questions on 12? Go on to 13, please.
Mr. Chairman, slide 13 compares the position count in different versions of the budget. So the governor's budget increased the number of permanent full-time positions, and these are just full-time positions, not part-time or temporary, increased the position count statewide by 260 beyond last year. The Senate finance budget in front of you actually is 43 positions below the governor's request. So even though the budget as a whole is higher, in terms of full-time positions, it's actually a bit below. So it is still a substantial increase, 217 positions higher than FY22, but is 43 below the governor.
Okay. Any questions on this slide? And the last slide, Mr. Painter, you've been looking for that slide since January when you started here, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think the end of conference committee is what we look for.
Okay, that's close. Okay, so that concludes. Any final questions for the
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hoffman?
What's a conference committee?
We'll teach you that on the way out the door, Senator Hoffman. The next step, well, we're going to do some action here, but for those watching home, the next step will be working, major step, after the floor action will be working the final budget out with the other body. So those watching at home, there will be some changes before the actual final budget. So do we have any other questions on the omnibus bill before we ask the co-chair to make a motion? Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee move Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for HB 281 Version Y to the next Committee of Referral.
And do I have an objection? Seeing none, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee direct the divisions of Legislative Finance, Legislative Legal, to make technical and conforming changes to the bill as necessary.
Objection or concerns on that? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and allow them to do that. Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee move Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for HB 282 Version G to the next Committee of Referral.
That is, for those watching at home, that is the mental health budget. Do we have objection on moving the mental health budget? Seeing none, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee direct the divisions of Legislative Finance, Legislative Legal to make technical and conforming changes to the bill as necessary.
Any objections on that? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move that. That's going to conclude the meeting today. We're scheduled a meeting at tomorrow at 9 a.m. We may be readjusting that schedule on those posted bills, depending on the activity that some of the committee men have tomorrow. So that's going to conclude our meeting today. But I'd like to just mention, I'd like the committee members come into my office, please, along with the staff, Finance Committee staff, and the legislative aides here after this meeting, please. We are adjourned at 3:22 p.m.